Hello, hello, and welcome to the Ideas Sleep Furiously podcast. I'm Matt Archer, and I have a smidgen of housekeeping for you this week. So we've just launched the 2022 Dysgenic Award nominations. We asked our readers to nominate the best people to have died childless in 2022, and thus removed themselves from the gene pool and made our species weaker by doing so. And we have five nominations. And we're asking our readers to pick the winner. So we have Joseph Ratzinger, aka Pope Benedict, Sol Kripke, we have Shinzo Abe, Terry Teachout, and Stephen Goldberg. And at the time of recording, Sol Kripke is in the lead with 53% of the vote. So if you want to influence the outcome, you need to click on the link in the description. The nominator will receive a $250 Amazon gift card, so it is all to play for, with only 4 days left until the poll closes. Okay, next piece of housekeeping. We are looking to rebrand. We're looking for a new name. So if you'd like to suggest anything, you can tweet at us at ideas_sleep. You can leave a comment on the YouTube video. You can send an email to ideassleepfuriously@protonmail.com. Or you can leave a comment on our Substack, whatever is easier. And perhaps we will give if we pick someone's suggestion, we will give them a little something as a reward. But now on to the podcast this week. And it's a bit of a different one because we are introducing our latest host on the channel. I don't want to say ISF because it won't be ISF for much longer. So it is my pleasure to introduce Diana Fleischman. For those that don't know, Diana is an evolutionary psychologist. In fact, she identifies as one of the very few behaviorist evolutionary psychologists, and we talk in the podcast about what this means, why it's interesting, why it's important, how it can in many ways outpredict evolutionary classical traditional evolutionary psychology, and why so many evo-sci people are hostile to it. We talk about Diana's background working with David Buss, and we talk about polyamory. We ask her all of the usual bonus questions, but this time we've kept them in. Usually they're for supporters, but you will get the full unedited conversation. So if you like this, then please do subscribe. That's both to YouTube and to our Substack. If you really like this, then maybe you want to support the channel by becoming a Substack supporter for just $6.99 a month or $69.99 a year. And for that, you get early access to these podcasts. You get exclusive access to the bonus questions that we ask our podcast guests. And you even get early access to the special films over on the main podcast channel. And there's much more this year coming in the pipeline. But without further ado, I give you a very fun, casual conversation with Diana Fleischman. Hey, Diana, this is my artificial hello, even though we've been talking for the last 5 minutes. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, nice to newly see you.
So seeing as this is a very different type of podcast, and you are not taking over, but you have your own show now, can you explain to people why you're doing this and how this came about?
Well, I'm not in academia anymore and I decided to ruin my life.
Good answer.
I did.
You were chatting to Johnny, right? You were chatting to Johnny.
Yeah, that's how I got introduced to you. I started listening to your podcast, which will have a new name soon. So why mention the old name? And I thought it was good. And I thought you were interviewing people that didn't get interviewed very many other places. I will not denigrate other places, but certainly I've heard other interviews with some of the same people as you. And the interviewers didn't seem to know as much about the topic at hand. And so I thought you were doing good work. And I was talking to Johnny and Amelie. We were hanging out in Austin, Texas, doing some networking. And I said, you know, I'm working on a book right now, but he said that you were looking for, you know, people to work at your outfit. And I said, well, you know, I have a child. I don't really have time to work full time. It'd be great to do some work that I really like and something that will encourage me to read more and network more. And this is the perfect marriage of those things. Yeah.
As any good behaviorist will try to set up their life. You're like, okay, I need an excuse to read more. So if I don't read, absolutely, I'm going to look like an idiot. So podcast the way forward.
And that's somebody who was very ill-equipped in many ways for academia, because I'm really out on the tail of extroversion, it's a good fit as well.
So are you actually going to go back to academia, do you think, at any point? Because your Wikipedia says that you're on sabbatical.
Oh, no. Well, I don't edit my own Wikipedia. That's not allowed. I am not on sabbatical. I was on sabbatical in 2019. So the first year I took off, I was technically on sabbatical. But I right now have an associate research professor position, which is a way of not having a gap in your CV, you know, having a title, not actually getting paid through a university. There are some things I'm chasing up, but it would have to be a special kind of place for me to go back to academia. Academia is an incredibly cush job. I'm not saying it's not, mm-hmm. but most departments are not very friendly to, most departments want me to get grants, and that's obviously quite difficult to do with various interests. And even with mainstream interests, it's very difficult to get grants. And, you know, Research One institutions, if you take a break and write a book and do other things, they have a bunch of people coming in who have evidence of research output every year of their lives. So why would they take a gamble on somebody who does not have that, right?
Do you, with the book's going to come out next year, right?
It should do if I finish it in the next 6 months, which is what I am on track to do.
So something like summer towards the, yeah.
The book is called How to Train Your Boyfriend, which is, it's an examination of how we use behaviorism in interpersonal relationships. So I'll talk about it later, but I read some behaviorism and I thought, why do people think this is antithetical to evolutionary psychology? Mm. We're all behaviorists. We evolved to be behaviorists. And it seemed patently obvious to me, but it's not really anything that many people have written about. There's an author called Karen Pryor, who I'll probably talk a little bit about as well. And she wrote Don't Shoot the Dog, terrible name for a great book, and a lot of other things. She was the first person to actually train dolphins.
That is quite the claim to fame.
Yeah, and you can't punish a dolphin because they just swim away. So you have to figure out a lot of things.
Wait, don't all fish just swim away?
Well, fish generally are hard to train. Although if you are listening to this and you're on a computer, you should look at Erasmus the Clicker trained fish. This woman I know called Alana Bram trained her fish to do like 7 or 8 different tricks, including go under a limbo hoop or limbo bar, play with a soccer ball, play with a small volleyball, do different kinds of spins, all with operant conditioning. He's a cichlid fish.
Before we get into like all of this really cool behaviorist evolutionary psychology, let's give people a bit more of a background about how you got into academia in the first place. So you're going back to your Wikipedia page. It says she was passionate about evolution from an early age, earning the nickname Monkey Girl from classmates at age 12. Please explain how this came about.
That's how I got interviews for grad school. Everybody's like, oh, the Monkey Girl thing. I almost didn't include it. And I was very lucky that my aunt and uncle, who were academically inclined, said, you know, this is gold and you should put it in. So I grew up in Marietta, Roswell, Georgia. And my father, bless him, decided that he was going to commute 30 miles each way, over an hour each way most days because of the traffic, in order to send me to the best public schools in our state of Georgia. And those public schools did not teach evolution. So around middle school, I became obsessed with evolution. My mother bought me this book called Evolution Book. I carried it around like a teddy bear. I was so obsessed with it. And I started talking about evolution amongst students. And yeah, people called me Monkey Girl. And the teachers, who also did not believe in evolution, were very critical of me at the time. And I was a weird kid, just generally, you know. And unlike many nerdy, strange children, I would not be ignored because I was also very extroverted. So I had this almost masculine disagreeableness in addition to being, you know, super extroverted and very interested in, you know, having my views heard. So there was a few years where I had a lot of friends and I was quite popular in elementary school, and then middle school and high school, sort of a mixed bag.
Would you have been classified as a gifted student?
I was at one point, yeah. We had a gifted program. I didn't make it in the first try. There was, I think they said I didn't get one question right. I was one question away from being qualified as gifted in like the fourth grade. And I remember it had something to do with spatial ability. There was like a
That's the
of a
less
screw.
Bad version of when like someone doesn't get executed because they score too high on an IQ test. So one question away from being officially clever.
So I was not classified as gifted until I was 10 or 11. And there was a gifted program, but honestly, it was mostly like doing crafts, things that my mother wasn't interested in helping me with, really. I think we had to cook something once, and I had never cooked anything in my life. We were supposed to make sweets and put them in a box and do branding, and everyone got help from their parents. And I think I put some like seeds and Hershey's chocolate in like little cups. I didn't know what to do.
This doesn't sound like a gifted program. This sounds like home economics.
It just gave us a bit more like free reign. They knew they could tell us to do kind of anything, and we'd be happy to do it. And and then in high school, I started, I think when I was in 16 or 17, I had a boyfriend who was 10 years older who sang opera, and he took me traveling and stuff, and I didn't really spend much time with normal high school people anymore.
And I guess maybe the next, what would you say, like milestone is working with David Buss. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. So I did finish. I went to a small liberal arts college in Georgia, and because my parents are educated and fairly smart, but they didn't really know much about going to university. My father went to university in England. My mother went to university in Brazil. They didn't really think much about, you know, where I could go to school. And I didn't really associate with a lot of other high achieving people in high school. So I just went to what I thought was the nicest place nearby. And I lived off campus in an apartment with these other women. And I had a wonderful time. And yeah, so that was called Oglethorpe University. But I also did 1 year abroad at the LSE. And that's where I discovered evolutionary psychology with a professor called Andy Wells, who was really charming. And we read Mating Mind, and we read David Buss, and we read Dawkins, Extended Phenotype, all that stuff. And I also took a class called the Psychoanalytic Study of Society with Chris Badcock, which he's the only person who I think has melded Darwin and Freud. And he wrote Psychodarwinism, which was my handle everywhere for a while, was Psychodarwinist. I didn't think about how that sounded. And Psychodarwinism, I think his most interesting idea from that book was that the Oedipal complex makes sense because toddlers are jealous of their parents' affections towards one another, and that enables them to prevent their parents from conceiving another sibling. And if you've ever been around a 2 or 3 year old, you'll know that they actually do seem to be optimized to cock block.
Did he at the time get criticism that this is yet another example of just so storytelling?
I mean, this was before people were doing a lot of internet criticism. This was back in 2001. So if there was a lot of criticism of it, I had no idea. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Eventually, I can't remember what turned him. He disavowed Freudianism. He was actually psychoanalyzed by Anna Freud, and he ended up disavowing Freudianism. I don't know how many of those ideas he stands by, but I think some of them are very good. And then I became completely obsessed with evolutionary psychology, and I wanted to study it. So I went back to Georgia. I worked at a chimp facility, a chimp and bonobo facility. They did some bonobo breeding. It was called the Language Research Center. One building there was called NASA because they actually trained monkeys to do various computer tasks to keep them occupied and entertained while they sent them into space. That was what originally was for. And I worked there on a project. Well, there was a chimp there. Her name was Pansy, and Pansy would direct you outside. So you'd bury food outside, and she'd direct you outside with a game of sort of warm or colder. Although if you got further away from the food, she just blanked you. She just stopped responding at all. But if you were moving towards the food, she'd pant hoot. She'd get very excited. And usually it's like M&Ms or, you know, other stuff that she wanted to eat. So she'd direct people outside of her enclosure to get her food and bring it back in. And I was in charge of making a map of the compound so that they could actually operationalize, you know, how good her spatial memory was. And that was quite interesting, although it's very, very distracting to work in the same building as four chimps. Hmm. Because they make a lot of noise and occasionally try to hurt people. So that's very distracting. I was not interacting directly with them. And then also the Sue Savage Rumbaugh worked there, and they had a bonobo program. And I remember she would feed the bonobos fried chicken. And so at one point, all of the primates at the center had to go on a diet, because some of the bonobos had gotten really fat from eating fast food. But it wasn't the chimp's fault. They didn't eat any fast food.
So wait, you didn't get hug any bonobos?
You don't want to hug a bonobo. Two of my colleagues were missing fingers from being too close to bonobos. So
what about baby bonobos?
I don't think that they bite your fingers off. And I've also never heard about bonobos, even in sort of a semi-captivity situation. I know another woman in the UK called Zana Clay, who works with bonobos, and I think that she's never had any problems with them. But yeah, Kanzi, who was like the male there, he bit off the whole finger of one of the caretakers, the whole middle finger. And then another caretaker was missing the whole first digit of her finger. So yeah. They just tried to get us. I mean, the chimps were also dangerous, but ironically, the non-behaviorists that I worked with, or they were not as into behaviorism, that, you know, if there was an aggressive attempt by one of the chimps, we were supposed to show like a united front. Not me, because I didn't work with them directly, but everybody went by and scolded the chimp who was aggressive so that they would know that we were all on the same team. And that seemed to actually work fairly well. Whereas Sue Savage Rumbaugh, who worked there, she slept in the same enclosure with the bonobos, and they never hurt her. She raised them from birth.
Hmm.
So, yeah. And that was interesting. I don't think I would ever work at a primate research center again. They were a little worried that I was an animal rights activist and that I was going to try to release all of the animals at some point. They asked me a lot of questions. Are your shoes leather? Stuff like that.
Why did they think that you might be an animal rights activist?
That was way before I was vegan. That was like years and years before I was vegan. And then I worked with David Buss. And I started there in 2002 or 2003. And I did my PhD on disgust. And I worked with David Buss, but I actually mostly did my work. My mentor and the person who probably helped me excel the most is a guy called Dan Fessler, who is an anthropologist at UCLA, and who's brilliant.
So what did you learn from your time working with the great Buss?
He was actually on a book tour, I think, the first year that I was there. Well, what I'll say about David Buss, he's obviously brilliant. And he's done a lot of work about various different topics. He is amazing at coming up with names for things that stick in people's memory. Like, he came up with mate poaching, which it tells you everything you need to know about what it is. You know, and compared to some other people that I think are brilliant, you know, like Julian Savulescu came up with the procreative beneficence, and you know, the hypothesis that I worked on that Dan Fessler came up with was called the behavioral prophylaxis hypothesis. Also not a very catchy name.
At what point did you start to become like semi-internet famous? Is this when you're doing your PhD?
Probably not. I did an Intelligence Squared debate before Intelligence Squared was really big, I think on feminism. And then I blogged. I had a MySpace blog, Matt. That was really good.
I remember MySpace.
But I don't think I was in any way internet famous. I had a dating, online dating page on Nerve, which was the best dating site at the time, I think. And all my colleagues, everybody in the lab found it before I got there and read it in great detail. So that was very amusing. And, but no, I don't think I became at all well known until maybe like 2010, 2011. And I wasn't on Twitter till after that.
What was the portal to this semi-internet fame then? Because I would have thought that Twitter gave you a massive boost, but you must have.
I didn't want to be on Twitter for a long time. I was on the Big Questions, and I remember looking over my friend's shoulder at commentary about me at that time, because they used to do, it's like the Big Questions in the UK is a Sunday show that 1 to 1.5 million people watch, and people often watch it after church, but most of the people who watch that show are not online. So even though they're like, tweet that the hashtag, the Big Questions, there's like 10 people who are tweeting about the Big Questions. Because most people watching the Big Questions are not on Twitter. They're not super
They're waiting for death.
They just went to church, Matt.
Same thing.
Exactly. So I did that a couple times, and then I got on Twitter. And I have no idea. It's all a bit of a blur. Like sometimes I look at the number of people who see my tweets and you know, or if I download Twitter on my phone, talking to 50,000 people is very strange.
How quickly did you climb up to where you are now, which is nearly 60,000?
Maybe there's some analytics that'll tell me. Honestly, I have a problem with Twitter. Like I'm addiction prone when it comes to video games and social media. Luckily, not drugs. I don't have a problem with drugs. I have a problem with
social media. Draw a hard line at heroin and cocaine.
Honestly, yeah. I've tried nearly every drug, and I've never had a problem. I've never had a problem, but Twitter, I cannot resist. If I get on there, I could spend literally all day. I think anybody who pops off enough on Twitter will become, you know, well known. I think that if you tweet hundreds of times a week about various subjects that you know something about,
you just need a few of them to go viral, right?
Yeah. I did a few tweets that went viral. I don't remember them that well. And I also did a podcast how old was I? In my early 30s, I started. So when I was 27, I became vegan, and I, like all newly converted people, was really hardcore. And then when I came to Britain, I went to a vegan meetup and I met another vegan, and we had a podcast called The Vegan Option. And let's see how many more times I can say vegan. That show was okay. He couldn't really ad lib, but he worked at the BBC and he was really good at doing the scripts and the sound and stuff. And we interviewed some people. At the time, I met David Pierce, who's really great, actually. He's a philosopher. And we talked about in vitro meat and that kind of stuff. And that was also something that I was somewhat known for. And this blog that I wrote about how vegans should eat oysters and mussels was, for some reason, very popular. And most people who first heard of me knew me because of my oysters and mussels blog.
Quite the entry wedge into Twitter stardom.
And that's where the sentientist moniker comes from, mostly.
Ah, okay, okay.
Yeah.
So, again, back onto the Wikipedia. Actually, no, this is not Wikipedia. This is on, I think, the Psychology Today, the first blog that you sent me, which I assume that you stopped writing because you're like, I'm just going to end up writing the entire book. So,
I think a monthly blog on there is perfectly reasonable, like excerpts from the book. Apparently, you could put your whole book online in blogs and people will still buy your book. So,
yeah, I think it's probably not. I've seen several people do this. On that first post, you write that you're perhaps the only behaviorist evolutionary psychologist. So, my question is rather obvious. One, what does that mean? Can you spell out what this means for people? I assume most people watching this obviously have a good understanding of evo sci. So, what does the extra adjective mean? Is that really true? And if it is, why?
When I was, learning evolutionary psychology, I'd always heard behaviorism presented as antithetical to evolutionary psychology. And certainly many behaviorists who work on human behavior think that there are a few general purpose learning mechanisms that govern our behavior, whereas evolutionary psychologists think that there are a large number of specific, what they call modules. These are mental programs that help us organize, process, and produce behavior in specific domains. Things that David Buss used to like to say to his evolutionary psychology classes: you might look for a crispy vegetable, but you don't want a crispy mate. You want to make sure you're using a specific module for mate choice. You don't have one module for vegetable choice and the same module for mate choice. And I think that most evolutionary psychologists, have no interest in behaviorism and are not behaviorists in any way, just because they don't know anything about behaviorism and because they don't see how behaviorism actually plugs into our evolved psychology. And behaviorists, for their part, tend to be the most hostile to evolutionary psychology. There's a lot of people who are hostile to evolutionary psychology, a lot of clinicians, clinical psych people, some cognitive psych people, but behaviorists seem to have, I'm generalizing because there are exceptions, very little interest in evolutionary psychology. So I just think it's not a, these two fields haven't really been married, not necessarily because they're antithetical to each other, but because people think they are antithetical to one another. And that's it.
So what I found really interesting here is the history of behaviorism and the cognitive revolution. Chomsky writes that, I mean, it goes obviously before Chomsky, got Piaget and whatever, but anyway, the story that most people who are interested in this stuff know is that Chomsky writes this searing critique of Skinner. And then you have people further down the line, like Seligman, learned helplessness. And behaviorism seems to just fade away. There's this huge emphasis, I guess, on the brain, because then we start to develop the tools to be able to do all these fMRI scans, EEG, whatever. But when I look at, for example, if you look at A-level psychology, the pre-university qualification in the UK, or just a undergrad textbook, and you just Google criticisms of behaviorism, I don't quite understand how behaviorism has went away so quietly, I guess. You sent me that article, I don't know where it was from, the 12-page one, where you're basically outlining what it means, what behaviorist evolutionary psychology can offer. Why is this not more popular? And can you explain to people, actually, its use value, where it can even outpredict evo sci?
Sure. I'll put that up on my Substack. It's on my old blog, but I'll put it up on my Substack before this interview goes out. So I don't think behaviorism faded away necessarily. People were finding exceptions to what were thought to be these very large rules. And Mm-hmm. It's possible that behaviorism was kind of promising too much, such that when people found things like learned helplessness or, you know, Garcia was studying things like super stimuli, these things, or what do they call that? Instinct. There's a thing where, like, if you train a raccoon to exchange coins for food with you, mm-hmm. eventually they won't want to give you the coin back and they start washing the coin like they wash their food. I think it's called like instinct preservation. Right. So there's these various exceptions. And I think people were saying that that debunked, you know, behaviorism, but people still use behaviorist principles to train dogs, to in special education, to train animals. And, you know, there are even some behaviorist books about using behaviorism in industry and at companies and in order to manage people. There is behaviorism all around us. It's just, I think Skinner maybe promised too much. As far as an evolutionary psych of behaviorism or behaviorist evolutionary psychology, the point that I make in that essay is that if rewards and punishments are the best ways to change other people's behavior, then we must have an instantiation of behaviorist principles in our behavior towards other people. And I talk about how you can see rewards and punishments in a lot of different relationships. So one of the big problems that evolutionary psychologists talk about a lot is like the problem of cooperation. You know, how do you get selfish organisms or organisms that are generally selfish other than to pursue their genetic interests to cooperate? And there are many times where cooperating makes the most sense from a selfish point of view. But if you want to change any behavior of any organism in a specific direction, using shaping, using iterated rewards is the best way to do that. And it would be very surprising to me if our evolutionary psychology didn't have that instantiated. And because I worked with David Buss and because I'm interested in relationships, you know, what is the most high stakes relationship that we have as humans that isn't, you know, naturally cooperative, right? Where two people are not necessarily aligned in their genetic interests, and those are romantic partnerships. So it seemed to me that we're going to see a lot of behaviorist interventions that are intuitively practiced in interpersonal relationships. But in that essay, I talk about some other things as well. You know, there's this, at the time that I started graduate school, David Buss had written a book called The Murderer Next Door. And there was a kind of interesting and spirited debate in evolutionary psychology about the origin of murder. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why do we murder each other? Why is murder a fairly common occurrence in more ancestral societies? And Daly and Wilson, who wrote an incredible book called Homicide, where they talk about all these different kinds of homicides, they think it's just a byproduct. You know, you want to intimidate somebody else and then you kind of accidentally kill them. The only, ironically, actual murder that they say is possibly adaptive in and of itself is infanticide, which is the most common form of homicide in most places. I'm hedging my bets here. I think it's the most common form of homicide, full stop. Mm-hmm. And David Buss wrote this whole book about homicide as an adaptation. But there's a lot of other questions, you know. So step parents are the most likely to kill children. You know, why do step parents, from an evolutionary perspective, you know, why would you bother beating your stepchild or verbally abusing them or whatever? It seems like a kind of waste of effort. And you mm-hmm. can really only understand that from an evolutionary perspective, right? If somebody's soliciting resources from you, you don't want to give them resources. You punish their solicitation so they stop soliciting resources from you. You know, abuse really only makes sense from a behaviorist perspective.
Do you think that part of the reason behaviorism faded away is because it also became, if we talk about the period, obviously, you know, 60s, 70s, this is when, you know, the cognitive revolution is really about to hit its peak. And obviously what's going on in American society at that time, with the civil rights movement, and the origins of behaviorism, and I guess maybe like some of the implicit values that people can be easily coerced, then perhaps they should be, because if you're not going to do it, someone else will. Do you think that also played a role? It was just kind of seen as undesirable.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of things that people hate about behaviorism, which is, I'm really drawn to things that other people find offensive. So yeah. People love the idea that we have free will and behaviorism is deterministic. People like the idea that, let's say I ask you why you like that pair of shoes instead of that pair of shoes, or why you engage in certain behaviors, right? People like the idea that you can ask somebody about why they do things and their explanation means something. Whereas behaviorists by and large say, asking people for explanations of their behavior is not really, you don't get a lot of information that way. You just observe them. You observe what they do in various different environments and in response to various different stimuli. And you figure out what people's preferences are more honestly that way. And, some of the stuff that is attributed to Skinner is not always true, but he was a character who liked to talk about behaviorism as being able to solve all of society's problems. And after these holes were poked in it, that's why it collapsed a bit. But he does talk about private behavior, or which are things like thoughts. But he also says you don't necessarily need access to those things. And with the cognitive revolution, that just became much less fashionable, the idea that you could tell everything you needed to. And I think people, if you look about humanism and things like that, people are offended that you could understand human behavior by studying rats and pigeons. Even now, there's a guy called Alfie Cohn who wrote Punished by Rewards. He's a very big critic of behaviorism. And I had seen his name all over the place. So I listened to several different interviews with him. And he's just constantly talking about how offensive it is to use dog training techniques on people. And so I think all these things, and if you read Beyond Freedom and Dignity, which I'll talk about it now a little bit, it anticipates many of these problems that people have with it, that people don't like the idea that human beings are easily predicted or can be predicted, with these laws. And what I think, that I don't think Skinner necessarily goes so far as to say, is that people behave in a protean way. They behave in unpredictable ways as an adaptation against control itself.
Do you see a lot of similarities in the way that behavior genetics has been received, precisely because of that deterministic thrust that it has right at the core?
Yeah, I have something that I've been thinking about, but I don't know how much of this is, accounts for the zeitgeist we see now, where people are talking about not being a specific race or ethnicity. People are disavowing their, traditions, and also talking about being agender, non-binary, or having these various different unusual forms of identity. But I think people are profoundly averse to control. And part of being profoundly averse to control is being averse to even being categorized or having things about you that can predict you. You see a huge outcry if somebody says something to do with physiognomy, right? That the width of a man's face can predict how well they or how aggressive they are. People have called that phrenology. And it seems to me that the responses to these kinds of ideas are disproportionate to potentially how much, how unscientific they are. I've also seen people talk about, the Chinese government trying to make a database of faces. Ironically, the Chinese government calls their database of faces the database of Oriental faces. We're not allowed to use the word Oriental anymore. But anyway, there's an Oriental face database. And so if you you can look at certain facial characteristics and how they correspond, and people don't even like the idea that their physical form in any way predicts what their what their personality is going to be like. And so I see all of these manifestations, yeah, as manifestations of aversion to control. Because
can I ask, is that, do you think that that is actually it's exacerbated by modernity, like by the from the 60s counterculture onwards? Do you think that there's always something there? You know, if you went back 300-400 years and you told a farmer or a philosopher, an intellectual, stuff like this, you know, they would still have a slight unease. And then that was taken to new heights in the age of individualism. Or do you think actually these people were very different and they might not have had that eeriness about it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So yeah, because of, you know, government and social safety nets and networks and infrastructure, there's more different ways to control people than there have been before, right? And so that is a squeeze. Some people even find it creepy, you know, if their Spotify suggests a song that they might like, or, you know, or targeted advertising. These are things that people find somewhat creepy.
I have friends who are convinced that Instagram is listening to them because the algorithm is just that good at saying, oh, you want a coat, and you yesterday, or even like an hour before, they're like, I need a new winter coat. And they just can't wrap their head around the fact that they're predictable.
It's winter. They were looking at coats last week. Yeah. Exactly. You know, if we evolve to control each other, as I think we do, this is also, you know, this goes back to some other ideas that are unsavory in evolutionary psychology. You know, the idea that men evolved to sexually assault or rape women. Well, if men evolved to sexually assault women, then you would see a counter adaptation such that women avoid men who potentially could rape them. And in similar way, you know, if we evolve to control one another, then we also have adaptations to evade control. And what I think part of our difficulty in understanding human beings' psychology and the human condition is this inherent evasiveness that we have, where we actually don't want other people to predict us.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I think you should write this up as a Substack piece. It's a nice fusion of, I think, evo sci and, you know, history of ideas. I think this has got the potential for virality.
I'm much better at talking than writing, which is the curse of the extrovert.
You can you can dictate it like Hans Eysenck used to do. Apparently, he just dictated all of his books.
Sometimes this is how I've written some of the chapters of my book. In the outset, is that my husband will just sit down with me and ask me questions, and then I just dictate to him. Dictating by myself is difficult for me.
Yeah. I wonder why that is.
It's like giving a talk for your cat. You ever given a talk for your cat? I used to have cats, you know, and they just don't give you much back.
Yeah, because I was thinking, like, is it a process of, you know, they're allowing you to refine and build your ideas? And I'm not sure it is, because sometimes I could just speak for 20 minutes, you know, at someone. I wouldn't, because that's rude, but I could, you know.
Well, I just even think it's social rewards, right? Speaking myself, I don't get any social rewards. And on top of it being, you know, difficult to kind of keep going by myself, you know, if I was just thinking boring, about somebody specific I wanted to impress, or like a group of people I wanted to impress, this is also when I used to write lectures for students, because undergraduates are often, shall we say, not incredibly enthusiastic to be in lecture hall. You know, it's great to imagine whoever your most engaged, most admiring student is. Yeah.
So let's move on to some of the applications of this updated evo sci framework, where we're integrating some of the classic insights of the behaviorists. I think if we pick one domain, you know, perhaps the most interesting and useful domain, relationships. I think you and your husband Jeffrey did a presentation. I think I saw it on YouTube many years ago, and then I looked for it a few days ago, talking about this idea of like dull. Yeah, the Nudge Talk one. Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes. This idea of like Darwinian couples therapy. I really, really like this. And again, it's one of those things where I'm like, why? Please explain to me why this isn't, you know, if you go to some, I don't know what they have in the States, but if you want a therapist in the UK, you can actually select on a lot of these websites filters, you know, humanistic approach, cognitive approach, holistic approach, whatever. Why is there no, and obviously you can go on couples therapy, why is there no Darwinian approach to not just couples therapy, but therapy generally? It seems like a no-brainer, right? This is kind of what the manosphere is, just utterly reductive.
Yeah. Yeah, this is kind of the interesting thing about like Red Pill and Manosphere is that they do get a lot of stuff wrong. They get a lot of stuff right. And it seems like men are uniquely interested in having their behavior described by evolutionary psychology. So one reason is, rightly or wrongly, people think that when you use evolutionary psychology to describe your behavior, you're saying that you are helpless in the face of these forces, these, you know, forces of natural and sexual selection. So, you know, if I was to talk to a clinical psychologist who just knew the stereotype of evolutionary psychology, you could imagine them saying something like, well, yeah, I could do couples therapy, and the man would cheat on the woman, and he would say, you know, it's my biological imperative to have sex with other women. I want to spread
my seed.
Yeah.
Jinx 1, 2, 3. I now have to say your full name, otherwise you can't speak. Those are the rules of the playground.
We went to the thrift store the other day, and they had a grass seed thing in a package, and it said seed spreader. we should get this. So that's one problem people have with it. Another problem is that, you know, people just don't know much about evolutionary psychology. Evolutionary psychology is associated with a lot of other unsavory beliefs that are out of fashion, things like sex differences. Although evolutionary psychology has staunchly been against, from its outset, any discussion of differences in psychologies between populations. They talk about the psychic unity of mankind. And most evolutionary psychologists that I know of are actually still very against the idea that that ethnic groups can differ in any kind of fundamental psychological way. So that's also a stereotype that people have about evolutionary psychology. And it just is seen as excusing behavior. I'll be interviewing Louise Perry pretty soon, and her book, The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. Unfortunately, you can't tell from the title, but it actually goes further into talking about why things are difficult to change from an evolutionary perspective compared to, you know, most books that I've read. Compared, you know, the most I've seen this done since like a natural history of rape, and certainly one of the best treatments I've seen from a non-evolutionary psychology person. Yeah. So there's other people who try to do it. Todd Kashtan and Amy Alcon and some other people have tried to apply evolutionary psychology to self-help. But it hasn't really gone very far, I don't think.
Could we give an example, just a run-of-the-mill, you know, something very mundane that all couples will face, where this insight will allow them to tilt their perspective a little and think, oh, actually, yeah, I didn't think about that. I mean, a lot of therapists say, you know, the goal of therapy is just feeling better, right? You know, you go in and you get something off your chest, and as long as you feel better, that's great. And you look at meta-analyses of different therapeutic, you know, you can look at Freudian therapy, you know, often dismissed as pseudoscience. And from what I don't know if this is recent data, but I remember when I looked it up many years ago, it didn't seem to differ that much between, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy and God knows what else, you know, holistic humanistic therapy, because it's just the, as I think R.D. Lang showed, just, for example, being able to type into a computer and have the computer mirror back what you say, you know, I know it's like, I'm feeling bad today because I lost my job, whatever. And then it just asks, you know, a basic therapeutic question.
Yeah.
You know, everyone knows the trope of, oh, so how does that make you feel? And that enables people to feel better. So anyway, this is a massive digression, but yeah, how does Evo Psi improve upon the standard toolkit of the therapist?
Yeah. So first thing I'll say is, you know, one thing that's puzzling to me is, why does disclosure feel good? Why does it feel good to tell people what's going on with you? That's quite interesting, I think. I mean, it obviously implies trust, but it could be really scary. You know, it could be like falling backwards into somebody's arms, you know, mm-hmm. not something that people tend to do. So it's interesting that disclosure feels good and people enjoy disclosing to a stranger that they pay money to. That's odd and mm-hmm. not necessarily something I would predict. I like to be clear about things I wouldn't predict, you know, from first principles. Yeah. So that people know that there are definitely gaps in my predictive powers. I would never predict that. Some kind of couples problem that can be easily talked about. Well, one of them is, you know, women often have this problem with men not wanting to talk to them about whatever their problems are. Women often want men to disclose more. Women are more disclosive on average than men are. And one problem, as I see it, is that women are often also assessing men on a regular basis for their quality, you know, assessing them for their current status, who wants them, who doesn't want them, how they're doing in the community. And in our ancestral past, people would have not stayed with one person forever. They would have traded up if possible. And so I think that women have this running quality assessment that they do with their mates. And I think men are averse to that quality assessment. So, you know, one thing that people talk about a lot is how, you know, women convince men to go to the doctor, or women convince men to tell them about their aches and pains. But men often don't even want to, you know, tell a woman that they're sick or injured, or that they are making less money or having troubles at work, or any variety of other things that might reduce their estimation of them as a current partner, because men don't want to be traded away, and because women initiate the vast majority of breakups.
Okay, so let's go on to our bonus questions, the ones that you will be asking of other guests. So who is the best critic of your worldview?
Well, I just finished The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. And I don't know if there's anybody who... So my worldview tends to be very sort of rationalist. And I find critiques of rationalism, you know, tend to talk about how we should use intuition and emotion and tradition more often. Maybe these are compelling to some people. I don't find them particularly compelling. I think that Louise Perry comes at maintaining some traditional institutions. And, you know, she's anti-pornography, she's anti-sex work. And she comes at these things by appealing to evolutionary explanations and appealing to potential harm. Both of these things are things that I find somewhat compelling compared to other arguments that I've heard. So I would say Louise Perry is a good critic of at least my worldview in the sexual domain, and things like, you know, pro-sex work and pro-pornography stances that I hold. She hasn't changed my mind, but she has, as some of the rationalists say, you know, you could say that you've updated, right? So like if somebody tells you a position, you don't necessarily completely change your mind, but you can start to begin to doubt that you're right necessarily. Mm-hmm. And that's, obviously the first step to changing your mind.
Yeah, yeah. The Socratic self-doubt. So do you actually remember the last major position where you changed your mind?
I mean, there's so many things. I was not going to have a child unless I met somebody who I thought was going to do a similar amount of childcare as me. And I had pretty much committed to not having a child. And then I did. I wasn't necessarily very keen to get married. And I did. I have a more traditional kind of conventional life now than I did pre like 2018, for sure. I was really vegan and pretty stridently so. But that was kind of little by little, you know, eating cheese here and there kind of a thing. And then eventually I'm not calling myself vegan anymore. I don't think I've fundamentally updated about that necessarily. I just think that there are some lives of animals where they die at the end of those lives that are still good. I don't think I would say, you know, Robin Hanson, who talks about how factory farmed animals' lives are still worth living. I don't think I would go so far as to say that, but I think some animals who are bred to be eaten have lives worth living. So that's something that I didn't necessarily agree with before. So those are some fundamental things I've changed my mind about.
And what's your favorite fiction and nonfiction?
My favorite nonfiction is Beyond Freedom and Dignity. It's great. I think I've read it 3 times. You know, Skinner really gets to the heart of what I think is the problem with top-down control and control and psychology more generally, in that we're actually ambivalent about understanding human beings because of the possibility of control and because of the idea that if we understand everything about humans, that they lose their dignity. He's got a really great chapter or passage in A Technology of Behavior where he talks about how they used to think that objects accelerated as they moved because they were more jubilant. They became more jubilant as they moved. And he said, obviously, we couldn't understand physics with that kind of a worldview. And we're not going to understand human beings with that kind of a worldview either. So, you know, he's talking about making fundamental laws. And at the time, he talks about how, you know, we can put a man on the moon, but we can't encourage people to get educated or use contraception. And these are still the problems that we have today. So I think it's held up in some ways, unfortunately, it's held up very well. Best fiction. I love Walden too, but it's actually not great. Like, it's not super entertaining. It's not super well written, but it is Skinner's idea for a idyllic utopian society. And utopias always have these various problems, but I think he gets a lot of things right. He talks about people sleeping in separate beds. I think that's great. I don't think anybody sleeps very well on the same bed. In Walden 2, it's kind of the logical conclusion of a bunch of ideas that people have now, but that people would never take to those logical conclusions. So for example, if you have an education system that is optimized to get the best potential out of children, or if you have a science of child rearing or child development that is ideal, then it actually doesn't make sense for you not to take advantage of economies of scale. It doesn't make sense for there to be a nuclear family and for parents to raise their children. It makes sense for children to be more centrally brought up. And, you know, he's got all these different examples of children learning various things in Walden too. Another thing he talks about that I think is eugenic is in Walden too, they encourage people to get married young and to have their children very young. So most women are mothers by the time they're, I don't know, 22 or 23, not like me. And so he talks about, you know, you have your children and then because they're centrally raised, you can kind of get on with other things that you'd like to do. And just the cooperation schemes. I think it's quite an interesting examination. The book that I love the most that's nonfiction, so that's fiction, is probably Oryx and Crake, which is Margaret Atwood. It's a great, great book. It's sort of dystopian in that in this near future. And if you're planning on reading Oryx and Crake and you can't stand to know anything about it, you should skip ahead. But, you know, it's this future where there's genetic engineering, but there's also so much crime. There's such a stratified society in terms of who has bred and who hasn't bred that, you know, different enclaves have, you know, their own diseases. You have to get vaccinated to go outside of a walled armored compound. And it's got this internal story of these friends who meet online. And, you know, people have made a lot of The Handmaid's Tale. I think The Handmaid's Tale is really good. I think what they did with it on TV is tragic. But I think that the specific, you know, Handmaid's Tale is good. But Margaret Atwood has written some other things that are really great. Don't Shoot the Dog, which is Karen Pryor, is a very short book. It's nonfiction and it will improve your life. You know, it'll teach you, like I was talking with Simone and Malcolm Collins, and she says, Karen Pryor says something like, if you have a behavior that you don't like among children, then you can put it under stimulus control. So she talks about there's this dolphin, and when he's unhappy, he like sinks to the bottom of the tank and he just doesn't do anything. And so she makes a command, which is sink to the bottom of the tank and do nothing. And she rewards him for that. And then he stops doing it for no reward because he wants to get rewarded for it. And she says that you can do the same thing with children. Like if they're, you know, they have chaotic energy, if they want to run around, you could put that under stimulus control. You could say, okay, the next 5 minutes is crazy time, and you reward them for that. And without getting into like the studies or whatever, if you do that, it becomes less intrinsically rewarding to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you want to do it for a reward if you've been rewarded for it before. So I think don't shoot the dog. Karen Pryor has also written another book of essays called On Behavior, which is just amazing. And I think she's really undervalued as a writer and thinker in general.
I want to read the first paragraph of Oryx and Crake, because I think it's such a beautiful series of short sentences that, I mean, it's so immersive. I love Margaret Atwood. So chapter one, Mango. Snowman wakes before dawn. He lies unmoving, listening to the tide coming in, wave after wave, sloshing over the various barricades. Wish, wash, wish, wash, the rhythm of heartbeat. He would so like to believe he is still asleep. Now, if I could write half as well as that, I would be, I would die happy. Have you read The Blind Assassin by any chance?
Yep. I've read most of her books, I think. Yeah.
It's another
I don't read much fiction. I do read, although, what's it called? Children of the Flood? Not great.
Yeah, I gave up really after Oryx and Crake. I enjoyed it, but I thought it was too long. I was kind of done with that world. Maybe I'll come back to it one day. But I really like the story within a story within a story.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
The Blind Assassin and the sci-fi element within like this very realist story. Okay, so the smartest person that you have ever met.
Yeah. I talked about it last night with Jeffrey. I was like, I'll just say you, Jeffrey, no. I'm going to mention a couple people. Generally, if I meet somebody and they're not very conversationally adept or they're not very effusive or extroverted, it's difficult for me to fully appreciate their intelligence, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are all kinds of smart people you'll meet, and then you'll never know that they're very highly intelligent because they're not using it to show off. So I would say, you know, Nick Bostrom is probably the smartest person I've met who doesn't, you know, I hung out with him a few times, one time while he made a green smoothie, and he's quite friendly, but he's very, very interested in like getting back to work. Lita Cosmides and John Tooby are the founders of evolutionary psychology, and they're brilliant. And it's actually difficult to tell because they rate so much together. You know, there's this evolutionary psychology power couple, you know, where John's intelligence ends and, you know, Lita's begins, because they really extract from each other, and you could tell that they work together and they have this perfectionistic aspect. Lita is absolutely brilliant, and they've come up with so many ideas that have revolutionized the world, you know, and certainly our field. I was at a conference with John Tooby back in 2019, where he talked about the magic of having children. To my colleague, I was sort of overhearing, I was sort of nearby, and he actually strongly influenced me to have a child, even though he was trying to convince somebody else to have a child who was right next to me.
Just by osmosis. Yeah.
Well, he said,
spreading the seed.
I mean, apparently he also said this to Jeffrey, because Jeffrey's known him, you know, for whatever, 25 years or something, but that having a child is like going through a membrane into a magical world. And there are people who live on one planet and there are people who live on planet parent, you know, and in the day to day of having a child, certainly I don't feel like every moment is magical, but I do see where he's coming from. And I'm grateful to him for encouraging me. The last thing I'll say about intelligence is I think people are at their most intelligent in terms of showing off, like peacocking their intelligence when they are in love, newly in love, in courtship mode. So back when I was in my early 20s, I was helping organize the Human Behavior and Evolution Society, which is the Evolutionary Psychology Conference in Austin, Texas. And I was sort of put in charge of entertainment, hospitality, whatever. So I got to pick up a bunch of people from the airport. And I picked up Steven Pinker and Rebecca Goldstein from the airport. And I put them in my tiny Honda Civic to take them to the hotel. And I think that Steve had been dating Rebecca for maybe 6 months, not very long at that time. And he was still very much in, let me show you how smart I am, very much in courtship mode. So he was in my front seat and she was in the back seat. And he told her about everybody she was going to meet at the conference, including, you know, Napoleon Chagnon. Mm-hmm. And just the fluency and the beauty with which she spoke about everybody and everybody's ideas and what she was going to hear there was, you know, really captivating. And I was also talking with Jeffrey about, you know, when we were long distance, he used to write me science fiction stories where I was characters and people we knew were characters in these stories. And he would write for hours these fantastic stories for me. And, you know, I think it's certainly people can be very intelligent in the service of higher goals. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, you know, the beauty of expression, I think it's hard to beat, you know, how people are conversing and producing when they are either newly in love or courting somebody that they really like.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's also worth saying that, and Nathan Kofnis alluded to this yesterday, and obviously he's going to be your first interview that people will see. You know, there are plenty of people with probably very high IQs, but are they the most intelligent? I mean, there's something more than just a very high IQ score. I've met a lot of people who are probably, you know, 160, 170 level. Okay, not a lot, but some. Yeah. And, you know, some of these people strike me as you know, idiotic in, you know, the way they live their life, the opinions that they have. You know, are you intelligent if you've got an IQ of 160, but you're wrong about most things? I mean, that doesn't seem like a very congruent common sense definition of intelligence, right? There's a lot more than just raw computing power.
You know, and Jeffrey, my husband, who wrote Mating Mind, you know, he fundamentally argues that intelligence is meant to show off, you know, ideally to mates. And so I do think that when you see somebody in courtship mode, you're seeing at least, you know, one of the most vigorously beautiful aspects of intelligence.
Amen. So final question then. What is your most controversial opinion?
So there's this Nick Bostrom quote that says, you know, the process of evolution would never pass an ethics review board. And so I guess my most controversial opinion is, you know, we find nature beautiful. We go out and see mountains and we see nature programs and rivers and forests, and we think they're beautiful. And so we have this feeling of well-being in these environments for Darwinian reasons. It's called Darwinian aesthetics, actually. But actually, nature is evil. you know, nature causes a huge amount of suffering. And, you know, nature obviously is amoral and doesn't care. But the whole process by which all these beautiful things evolved, the endless forms most beautiful, was a process of, you know, billions of years of tremendous suffering. And there's a certain melancholy that I feel, which is why it's controversial, that I don't feel like anyone else feels in natural environments in this way. Although there's some effective altruists. I like to watch nature documentaries, although I get less pleasure out of them than I used to. And I remember watching them with people who were interested in wild animal suffering, which is a more controversial and niche cause area. And, you know, people actually not being able to stand watching the mountain goat being chased off the cliff by the puma or whatever the case may be. So, yeah, nature is evil.
I like that. That's an original one. Before we finish, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you something about polyamory.
Because oh, no, I thought I escaped.
Oh, no. No. This is obviously, if people whack in your name to YouTube,
oh my God,
they'll see a really, really good interview with you and Jeffrey on, what was it called? What's that show called? The one that you did?
Rebel Wisdom.
Rebel Wisdom, yeah. They spliced two interviews together. And I don't really know a lot about this, but I'm quite interested philosophically in this idea, right? Because you said something earlier when we were discussing behaviorist evolutionary psychology about, I forget what it was now, something about courtship. And it struck me as like going and actually linking this to what you were just saying about nature. If the transhumanist idea or just like life extension technology really does fulfill some of the promises that its most ardent advocates put forward, and it could be that we live till 130, 140, and if you live that long, then maybe you'll find another extra 10-20 years and you can kind of just keep going. Surely, okay, I'll be very, very careful with my choice of words here as someone who is in a relationship. But do you not think it's rather common sense that like monogamy is the default operating system of a culture and a biology where we're basically living for a very short period of time? And if we lived for 200, 300 years, surely you would see more people being poly and that being accepted as a kind of not even a minority position. And if that is the case, then what does that necessarily entail anything about our current culture? Should we take anything from that lesson, right? If this is just kind of a cultural norm, a lot of people would say, okay, well, so what, we do live for 70 80 90 years at best, so yeah, we're obviously going to stick with the system.
That's a long time. You're like, 70 years with one person. Okay, yeah. 200 years. That's where I draw the line.
I'm out. You had me at 120. I can't do another 80.
Yeah, Jeffrey and I have sort of struggled. So despite what many people might think, or not the manosphere, who think that I am some kind of witchy woman who's like sorcered him, but most other people think that he convinced me to be poly. I was poly first. I met him while I was in an existing relationship.
Poly before it was cool.
I was not. Yeah, actually, I was poly before it was cool. But I met him while I was in an existing relationship. The person I was seeing encouraged me to date Jeffrey Miller because he was a fan of Jeffrey's books, and that's actually how I started with Jeffrey. Was sort of that way. So, and then I saw him sort of intermittently. I encouraged him to date other people because I was actually not his girlfriend. Poly is a very strange term. And unfortunately, many people who are poly are dating. They're trying to fall in love with as many people as possible. They're doing like a Pokemon collect them all kind of a thing where they seem to be, there's actually even a cute word in poly when you have enough partners that you're not trying to find anymore, which is polysaturated. We have our
playing fast and loose with the word cute there.
Whole lexicon. Some people don't think it's cute. I think it's very cute. So Dan Savage, who's a sex columnist, who is not somebody who would agree with me, nor would I would agree with him on many things, but he's got a word called monogamish. And monogamish is a relationship structure where you just have some permission to step out, on occasion. And I've likened this to buildings in Japan, which are built to actually withstand being shaken to some extent, right? I think very strict monogamy is actually quite brittle unless you are a naturally monogamous person. And I think naturally monogamous people are a small percentage of the population. Now, I think actually monogamy, quote unquote monogamy, where you cheat on your partner, like once every couple years, also works very well for most people. And that's what most people do.
The Mediterranean method.
I mean, it's how most people do it, right? They just have sex with other people occasionally. They regret it. They go back to their normal lives, or, you know, they'll have a brief affair. The partner will figure out something is going on. As Peep Show says, one will wait for the other one to get tired of humping the third party. And then, you know, that's it. I feel like what we do has a number of advantages. And, you know, one is that it's more flexible. I'll also point out that I have a small child. I'm not dating anybody other than my husband at the moment. But one thing that we can do is I can have, I dated, I don't know, you know, 6 or 7 people in the UK. And in the United States, I have people that I have what I call romantic friendships with, people that I have dated, could date again. And one thing that is refreshing to me and that I wouldn't want to give up is my ability to connect with everybody that I've, you know, had this intimacy with over the course of my life. Whereas my impression from most monogamous relationships is it's very difficult to maintain these other relationships without causing anger, upset, arguments, and very involved negotiations. I can talk to whoever I like in whatever capacity I like. And, you know, I probably will, you know, date other people again at some point in the future. But what we are doing is trying to make a relationship that is as fulfilling as possible for both of us and as resilient to possible romantic outside influences as possible. Because I don't think either one of us is actually very monogamously naturally inclined.
So is the number one weapon that you have to have in your arsenal kind of just radical honesty? So, you know, you could say, look, I'm pregnant, and even though we are technically, you know, poly, I don't want you, you know, I want you to be with me. This is obviously an incredibly important time, blah, 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 blah. And you just have to be, you know, blah, 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 blah. Please be with me. And you,
let me interrupt you very quickly. I thought being pregnant was going to make me incredibly jealous. And I thought having a small child would make me incredibly jealous. I was actually probably the least jealous of my whole life. I didn't expect this at all when I was pregnant and when I had a small child. Because I was so in love with my baby. I was like, go have a weekend away. I don't care. I'm just going to hang out with my baby. It's fine. So very strange, I know. Yeah. But
okay, so hypothetically then, yeah. if that were the case, if someone like, look, I'm pregnant, I want you to, do you, I guess it's a give and take, right? That's a reasonable demand. And
oh, yeah, absolutely. And actually, when I got pregnant, that's what we negotiated. I was like, look, I don't want to get upset at all about any of these kinds of negotiations when I'm pregnant. So why don't you just commit that we're going to be kind of conventionally monogamous, whatever, for 3 years. And then when I was pregnant, I'm not going to like go into too much detail, but, you know, I was certainly not super interested in seeing other people, but I honestly didn't mind. In some ways, I just felt like he couldn't be any more committed to me at that time than any more committed to me than he was at that time. Mm-hmm. Because he was showing me a huge amount of investment and love and affection and romance at that time. And we just, you know, a few things that I think are important in polyamory that I think other people don't get. So we've been very criticized for talking about how there's a certain level of intelligence, conscientiousness, and self-control and emotional understanding that you need to be poly. And, you know, I've even likened it to like maybe a luxury belief. Like, it's not something that I think everybody can do. And I don't think, say what you want. You can call me elitist. If I told people that everybody can do this and it's easy, then I would be screwing up people's lives and I wouldn't want to do that. The other thing is that my husband and I are very weird people and we're very uniquely compatible with one another. I have been engaged, proposed to, whatever, like people have wanted to marry me. I'm not bragging. I'm just saying other people have wanted to marry me. I couldn't have imagined marrying anybody You're else.
Beating them off with a stick.
I have made other people's lives miserable because I wasn't like, I was in a relationship that I didn't want to be in very much. I'm very happily married in a unique way. And Jeffrey and I are both really weird. If two people get together and all they have in common with one another is that they're attracted to each other and they're nice to each other, but they're otherwise very normal people, then they're not irreplaceable to each other. Mm-hmm. And anybody who comes along who's nice and attractive is a potential substitute for that person, right? So this is, I think, if you're going to open your relationship up, I think you either have to be irreplaceable to each other in whatever way that is, or you have to have enough history with each other that you've become irreplaceable to each other.
Which is kind of paradoxical to most people, right? Because they think irreplaceable and they think you're, I don't want to say, you know, property, but you are, if you're irreplaceable, then you're irreplaceable to me. So I'm not going to risk losing you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, another thing that I think having a slightly open or very open relationship, as I've said, I think this is Dan Savage is the first person who said this, is like, you know, you can have an open door. It doesn't have to be blown off its hinges, right? It could just be slightly ajar, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't have to always be, you know, trying to substitute other people, you know, in your life. You can have very intermittent interactions. People think polyamory and they think about the sort of most extreme, cringiest, you know, polyamorous that people have seen in the culture. I think we just like that word as opposed to like a non-monogamous or consensual non-monogamy. Oh, there's incredibly clunky words around this. We like it because we do love other people that we are with, not necessarily because we're trying to, I don't want to have children with anybody else. Mm-hmm. I don't want to marry anybody else. And I don't want anyone else to live with us, most likely ever. In terms of irreplaceability, when you have a slightly open relationship or a very open relationship, it emulates some ancestral conditions. Those ancestral conditions is that, you know, other people are interested in your mate if you have a valuable mate. If you are in a context where no one is ever expressing interest in your mate at all, you are getting cues that this person is undesirable and nobody else wants them. That's a very odd modern context that we live in. And so I do also think that having a slightly open relationship makes two people better to each other, makes them more interested in working things out and becoming irreplaceable to each other.
Yeah, I guess like looking at Ayla's recent work, her Substack posts that examine how many partners the average poly person has, you know, over the course of their lifetime. It just strikes me as a really good argument. You just look at what people, and the other work is obviously how many people cheat, how often they do it. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of combine those two things. It's like, yeah, I mean, you don't have to make the fancy kind of Bostrom type argument of, imagine if we live for 200 years and then what can we learn from that? You could just say, what do people do now? And it seems like a lot of people are cheating at least once or twice, and yeah, a lot of people in the poly situation don't have 3, 4, or 5 people on the go. It might be much more like monogamish, and so a lot of people also open up their relationship in what, like their 40s, 50s, 60s, I guess, when the, you know, the flame has long died out. So yeah, when you look at it from a more I guess empirical lens, it just becomes, I guess, much less intimidating than the, you know, the poly stereotype.
Yeah, the poly stereotype is super cringy. And even if you look at, like, you know, poly groups, it's like a lot of very unusual people, a lot of furries, like very few people with kids. Although I've known a bunch of people, poly people with children. I think, you know, one thing that people were looking at with Ayla's blog was like how few children poly people have. And I think that's more of a effect rather than a cause rather than, I think the people who don't have children, they just are much more likely to open up because destabilizing their relationship has fewer costs, you know, to whatever extent that they do that. I do think that I will write something about who I think can try open relationships, I think fairly, without nuking their lives. Certainly a lot of people open their relationships up because they're planning on breaking up and they'd like a little more time to find somebody else. This is, I think, one reason why polyamory gets such a bad rap is because it's something that people do right before they're on their way out.
But it's not like a last chance.
David Buss likes to say that people tend to brachiate, right? You want to be holding on to the next branch before you let go of the previous branch.
The monkey branching, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so most people, especially most men, who tend to be very unlikely to initiate breakups. Women initiate breakups when they found somebody else, and men don't initiate breakups. Men prefer to keep both women if possible. that's generally how that works.
Well, before this descends into just gossip, I think we'll call it time there. If people want to find you, where should they go to?
I have a Substack, obviously, that needs updating, which is called dianafleischman.com, which I also need to put my Substack on. My Substack
looks like it's from the 1990s.
Does
you
it?
You need to get on that, yeah.
Is it like GeoCities? No, I think it's fine.
Yeah, so I'm expecting like an AOL email address.
I need to sort it out. Yeah. Among many things. Yeah, my dissentient Substack, which I will add that behaviorism essay to it as soon as possible. I'm on Twitter at sentientist, which is, you know, from my eat oysters, they're not sentient days. it's kind of got a long history. Yeah, there's this whole sentience or sentientist movement. And I feel a little bit bad because, you know, I am not the sentientist movement. I am just the person who came up with the term or started popularizing the term. So
you're not the sentientist.
You don't have to be like a polyamorous IQ realist lapsed vegan to be a sentientist. You know, it's fine.
You too can do it.
So, yeah.
Cool. Thanks, Lady Di.
Okay. Thanks, Matt.